So thank you for this nice and short introduction. It's a nice short introduction. So I want to tell you about my research, and that's kind of the aim to construct quantum spacetime. And so here you will have the nicest picture of the entire talk. It's not done by me, it's done by Aldo. And if you manage it to the end of the talk, you will have the cutest picture of the entire talk. But that will be the end of 3 hours, of course. So, so what is quantum spacetime? Quantum spacetime will come with a theory of quantum gravity. And quantum gravity is supposed to unify the two revolutions we had in the 20th century, the quantum field theory and general relativity. And the problem is, if you want to couple basically quantum field theory matter to general relativity, we cannot do that by keeping general relativity a classical theory. And additionally, these two theories break down in very interesting regimes. And so we hope that we can construct a theory of quantum gravity. But gravity, as Einstein taught us, is actually encoded really in space-time geometry. So a theory of quantum gravity is actually a theory of quantum space-time. And here is another very heuristic argument why we need to replace our classical space-time picture if you really want to understand quantum field theory and general relativity as two phases of one theory. And if you want to resolve two very nearby space-time points, for instance, in via correlations functions in quantum field theory, you need a very fast clock. And that means you need a very high energy. But if you want to concentrate this very high energy on a short distance, what will happen is that you create black holes. So if you basically start with quantum field theory and take together general relativity, you get generically these creations of black holes in trying really to localize space-time points. So basically, the quantum space-time should, in particular, replace this notion of space-time points with some quantum notion. And so there are many exciting questions and very fundamental questions which you can ask with which come with the quantum theory of space-time. For instance, how did it all start, quantum space-time and the universe? How does it end? What is actually time, and what is actually the flow of time? Is causality fundamental? And so on. So let me just immediately jump in into the problem and what is the main thing you have to face if you think about quantum gravity. And that's gravity is a field theory. And so if you want to quantize it, you think about a quantum field theory, but this usually needs a regulator. But all the regulators we know actually use already a space-time background. For instance, if you want to put up a cutoff on energy, energy is something which is actually conjugated to time, so you need already a notion of a flow of time, but if you specify a time, that breaks diffeomorphism symmetry, which is a fundamental symmetry of general relativity. If you choose a lattice, that usually assumes also some background and breaks diffeomorphism symmetry. So one proposal which in principle could lead to a kind of diffeomorphism invariant regulator is that you actually sum over geometries which you get by assigning lengths to a fixed but random lattice. And that's this formalism is actually known as quantum ratchet calculus. So to just give you a very rough picture of what happens, here is a 2D picture. Where you fix the geometry of the boundary by saying, okay, you discretize it by defining a bunch of edges with fixed lengths. You triangulate the bulk, and you sum over all length assignments to the edges of the bulk. And as you can see, what can happen is that these edges, they can be very short, they can be very long. So there will be actually two questions here. The first question, what happens actually with the cutoff, which you usually have? And that's here you already see one difficulty because cutoff, if it's a length cutoff, here you sum over all lengths. So here we seem to integrate over arbitrary small and arbitrary large lengths. So we will see that we can actually obtain a quantum-induced cutoff, and that will appear in the main part of the talk. But the second problem is, what happens with diffeomorphism symmetry? And there's one problem, can you actually define a notion of diffeomorphism symmetry in the discrete? And the answer is yes, you can. But unfortunately, it happens that generically, this notion of diffeomorphism symmetry is actually broken. And what is the reason for that? The reason is that this action of the diffeomorphism symmetry, what it does, it really changes the edge length in the bulk. And it does it change it effectively so that basically these vertices move effectively around. But the important thing is that you can change these edge lengths so that you effectively probe all scales with a diffeomorphism orbit. But you usually discretize your dynamics, that is the amplitudes, based on some approximation. And this is usually just reliable on scales larger than the discretization scale. So what happens is that you don't really have an exact dynamics and make some mistakes in these approximations. And that leads to a breaking of the diffeomorphism symmetry. And so in fact, to obtain a diffeomorphism invariance, we need something which is called a perfect discretization. And so this is defined that the observables you can define in your discrete theory mirror exactly the corresponding observables of an underlying continuum theory. And in this way, you immediately, you are allowed to probe all scales at once. And in principle, such perfect discretizations can be obtained by a refining and coarse-graining process. So here, the slogan is that really diffeomorphism symmetry requires to construct the dynamics on all scales. And that's a hard part of implementing diffeomorphism symmetry, which is usually seen as a key requirement in constructing quantum gravity. So to address this problem of basically constructing the dynamics on all scales in some form, I developed this consistent boundary formalism. I'm not going to explain that here, what it is. What it delivers you is it's a formalism, a framework to construct better and better approximations to the exact dynamics of the theory. And the emphasis on boundary comes here because it allows you also to deal with non-local features, which are unavoidable for obtaining diffeomorphism invariants. The important point in this formalism is that it actually allows to get reliable approximations for low excited states, that is for large scales first, before really probing very high scales. And that's actually contrary to the usual viewpoint where you usually start with define a theory at UV and tries rather to get to the infrared by some coarse-graining process.
Sorry, I guess this shows my ignorance, but consistent boundary formalism sounds like holography, but is it?
There are some holographic features. I am not going to mention it a lot, but we can discuss it later. I mean, it comes up. So here I use something which is very undefined in general relativity, and that is low excited states and basically related vacuum and also large scales. A priori is not well defined. And so we have to ask what does vacuum mean and low excitations mean? And that will also come up in the main part of the talk. Okay. So to give you a bit of mind map of my research since 2012, apparently. There was this issue that diffeomorphism symmetry is broken in our attempt to quantize gravity. This consistent boundary formalism is a framework which tries to basically regain diffeomorphism symmetry and define a consistent dynamics for quantum gravity. What it so far led to are three different research directions which inform each other. And one is on a kinematical level, and it involves the definition, the construction of new quantum geometry realizations. The second is really dynamical. And the first aim here is to obtain something like the phase diagram of quantum gravity. And a newer research direction, quite a new one, is actually holography. And actually, in this case, to investigate dualities which can arise if you have a finite boundary as opposed to an asymptotic boundaries. And so these are basically three main research directions, and I won't have time to cover everything. So in this talk, I will mostly concentrate on this construction of new quantum geometries, and we will also see a bit how that helps for the dynamics of the theory. So that will be basically the main part of my talk. And I'm doing that because this already uses one basic idea we had, the idea of these perfect discretizations. So this idea of using discrete observables which probe a continuum theory, that is already realized in the kinematics of loop quantum gravity. And there was basically one way how this was implemented, and that was used for a long time. But we found other ways to implement it, and so different implementations of this concept will lead to different quantum geometry realizations, as I will show you now. So what now we want to do is to construct a Hilbert space, which carries observables of general relativity or the variables of general relativity, which would be a spatial metric and a conjugated momentum. Now, what has been basically found out by Ashtika is that you can replace these variables by other variables which are very similar to electromagnetic variables. They're basically just SU2, similar to Young-Mills generalizations of these variables. So we will have a magnetic field which will be captured by Wilson loops, which measure this magnetic field strength. And we will have an electric field. And this will be measured by basically electric fluxes, which are defined in 3 plus 1 on a surface, and which measure basically the electric flux along this Wilson line.
Can I ask a naive question?
Yeah.
So in wireless field theories, people discretize time by first going to Euclid. Are you staying with Lorentzian signature?
Here you can implement both if you want. So this is just a canonical formalism, and the signature is encoded only in the Hamiltonian and 3 plus 1.
But how is it usually done? Is it done with the Lorentzian or Euclidean signature?
We can do both. So, so SU2 also for both signatures.
But I guess the problem is that if you want to do path integrals numerically, then you have this sign problem.
I'll come to that.
Okay.
So, that's why we use tensor networks. So it's a different thing. So what we have here is a lattice, and we don't really see the lattice as just a discretization. We see that as picking out a set of observables, which we can basically define via this lattice. And the aim is here to keep this lattice, or to restrict ourselves to the set of observables as far as possible. But eventually, if you really want to define a continuum theory, you have to specify what happens if you actually introduce observables which probe smaller scales than this lattice, so which are finer than the given lattice. And so that's basically what is really needed, a so-called refinement map, to define a continuum limit of these Hilbert spaces. So we basically need to specify all the states which would basically sit, or the local degrees of freedom which sit on these additional degrees of freedom which come with the refinement. And how would you do that? Ideally, if you would have a notion of vacuum, like in lattice Young-Mills, the task would be to solve the theory and find some kind of a lowest energy extrapolation to a given configuration on this coarser lattice. It's a very hard thing to do. And general relativity, even that is not, you know, it's not useful to do because we don't have this notion of vacuum. But what you can ask is to implement symmetries, and in this case, you want to implement the diffeomorphic symmetry, which leaves your spatial hypersurface invariant, so the spatial diffeomorphisms. So the spatial diffeomorphisms would be just some kind of coordinate transformations, and they would act on the lattice and basically deform the lattice. And so since diffeomorphic symmetry is supposed to be kind of a redundancy, you want to eventually identify these two states as the same state, and in this way define a diffeomorphism invariant Hilbert space, at least if invariant under these spatial diffeomorphisms. And so you want to also then find kind of this refinement map or this prescription for the finer degrees of freedom, which would allow this identification. And in fact, there was a theorem which was called Lost Theorem, which was published around 2006, or talked about since 2002 or 3, and then it was lost for some time. And this is basically saying, so if you want to have really an irreducible representation, so irreducible means you have kind of the smallest possible ones, of your observer algebra of general relativity, which we chose here as Wilson loops and these electric flux operators, and you want to have this action of spatial diffeomorphisms, which I just described, there's only one choice. And this choice has been constructed in the 1990s by Ashtikar, Lewandowski, and initially Isham, and is known as Ashtikar-Lewandowski representation. And what it does, it basically prescribes that these additional degrees of freedom, they're all in a state that these smaller electric fluxes are all forced to vanish exactly. So it's a very simple state, which basically fixes all kinds of refinements you can draw here. This, you know, turned out to be the first spatially diffeomorphism invariant realization of a quantum geometry, and since the 90s has been the basis of loop quantum gravity. And in fact, the theorem told us, in principle, it's the only possible one, so it has to be the right one.
Should I worry that this sounds like it's slicing dependent if I go to a Boosted thing and it's expected?
Yeah, so this
or is it more subtle than that?
So this has to be taken care of by the dynamics of the theory, and now I'm speaking about the kinematics.
Okay.
So that's a very, you know, difficult problem in general, but okay. So this defines the notion of quantum geometry. And this is what kind of a typical LQG state then looks like. So basically we draw these nice graphs, and what is important here is only kind of topological information of this graph. And we label these graphs. In this case, it's SU2 spin representations. And these labels and this topology of the graph encodes a certain quantum geometry in the sense that these graphs actually define states which are eigenstates of spatial geometry operators. So we can define an area operator which is formed from fluxes, from these electric fluxes, and J1 would determine the area of this piece of surface. And similarly, we can define a volume operator and so on. And it's very encouraging that actually what one finds is that the eigenvalues for these operators are actually discrete. So what we get here is some quantization-induced UV cutoff. And we get this discretization. In principle, you get it really in the continuum theory. Similarly, he and Carlo Rovelli defined the spin network basis, which was also a nice gauge invariant basis for lattice gauge theory, and in this case is basically diagonalizing the electric flux operators. So that was basically a very nice picture of how to encode quantum geometry, at least with respect to the spatial diffeomorphisms, in an invariant way. But it also had some interesting feature or some annoying feature, which is that it mostly describes degenerate geometries. So I told you everywhere where there is no graph, the state is actually defined to have vanishing flux, vanishing electric flux. So electric flux encodes the spatial metric. So that means that everywhere where there is no graph, you have vanishing area. And so what you have to do is to kind of generate your geometry by Wilson loop operators, by applying the Wilson loop operators, from a vacuum state, which is actually defined to be having vanishing flux everywhere. That means vanishing metric everywhere. So it's a totally degenerate geometry. It's, of course, a very nice diffeomorphism in my own vacuum. But, you know, it's very hard to describe smooth geometry starting from the state. I mean, you can even make the argument that it's the most natural vacuum you can start with in the case of quantum gravity. So that, however, makes investigations of large-scale physics extremely difficult. And then there's a question, is there another possibility? So we had this uniqueness theorem which suggests that no. But in fact, if you think about topological QFTs with defects, which were kind of played always a role in the development more of the covariant version of IQG, seem to be really nice and also implementing a kind of diffeomorphism symmetry. Because for one, topological means that they don't need a background matrix for the definition. So they should be really nice in defining diffeomorphism invariant things, especially if you just ask about spatial diffeomorphisms. And defects, by definition, do not interact, and so do not see the distance between each other. And so they also don't need a background matrix. So this should be, in principle, an ideal setting for the kinematics of a background independent theory, where the defects can encode the degrees of freedom of a gravitational theory. In fact, you could even interpret the Arshtekhar-Lewandowski representation as implementing a trivial TQFT, because it doesn't see any topology differences, where you impose vanishing electric fluxes on your hypersurface, and where arbitrary many line defects are allowed, which can carry non-vanishing fluxes. And the diffeos, as before, act by basically deforming the graphs here.
Can I ask you something? Uh-huh. So the topological QFTs, these defects will carry mass or energy, right?
So in 2 plus 1, yeah, this is, yeah.
Well, 3 plus 1 as well. Right? Many, they concentrate mass or energy.
Yeah.
And when you apply it to your setup in quantum gravity, these should not carry mass or energy.
So there's two things here. One is kinematics, and one is dynamics. So if you say mass and energy, indeed, if you for one example, if I can do 2 plus 1 gravity, indeed is a TQFT, where I have these defects which are point-like, and where the dynamics tells me, it has a mass, basically, these defects.
Right.
And I can basically give them an action so that they're exactly solutions of this case. But I don't need to do that. I can try to give these defects another dynamics. So if you say energy, it's something which you decide by writing an action or by writing a Hamiltonian. And you can do that. I mean, there are Hamiltonians here, but you can decide what, in the second step, what kind of dynamics you give to the defects. That's an important difference in how I use the TQFT here. I only use it on this kinematic level, and so far don't specify dynamics for them.
So,
okay?
Torben, I think, are you going to either later modify your second or third point, or are we just going to get non-interacting gravitational theories this way?
Yeah, I talk about it in the end. That is
okay. Basically,
again, the question of dynamics. Mm-hmm. Which indeed the dynamics should make these defects interacting in some way. But the TQFT dynamics a priori makes them non-interacting. But you want to change that, of course, at some point. But here my point is that you can use the TQFTs to describe the kinematics, and we'll see how that is useful for the dynamics. Okay. So some time ago, we made a very specific suggestion how to use TQFTs together with the Stefax structure for the construction of quantum geometry realizations by really using the TQFT amplitudes to define these vacuum states and the associated refinement maps. And the question was, would that work? Because there was this uniqueness theorem. And indeed, it did work. And so in a series of works, which were actually very lengthy with Mark Gilea here, we defined a new quantum geometry realization, which indeed was realizing some quantum geometry, which in some sense is completely dual to the first one, to the Arshtika-Lewandowski one, where instead of vanishing fluxes, you have a vacuum state which is peaked on vanishing curvature of your connection. And this is based on a theory, on a topological theory, which is known as BF theory, which basically imposes vanishing connection and describes the moduli space of flat connections on a given manifold. And if you allow defects, then what happens in 3 plus 1? You have curvature defects which are now defined on lines. And so indeed, you can define a basis where you would have kind of a triangulation. And on the edges of these triangulations, you have curvature labels, which tell you the amount of curvature defined on these lines. And that's very similar to actually ratchet calculus, which we had in the beginning, because there you also work with piecewise flat building blocks and curvature defects on these edges. As I mentioned, for 2 plus 1, it actually solves the dynamics of 2 plus 1 gravity, and the point particles in this case can be indeed interpreted as point particles with mass and spin. What we now have is that in principle you can describe large scale geometries, because what we impose is flatness, as low excited states. So if you want to have lots of curvature, you need higher excited states. But usually we would associate high curvature also with high excitations. So that is basically kind of the opposite direction of excitation as we had in the Arshtika-Lewandowski case. Also, there's one big advantage that there's a much stronger connections to spin forms, which actually are a way to impose the dynamics via pass integral, because these spin forms are basically relatives of BF theory. Okay, so here I told you there's a new quantum geometry realization. It was the uniqueness theorem. So we somehow managed to avoid this uniqueness theorem. But also these two quantum geometries, I mean, I tried to tell you the typical states look very different, but they have also very different spectra.
Sorry, Bianca?
Uh-huh.
So two questions. So is this the version of BF theory where B has a gauge symmetry by a one form?
So B, yeah, so
B has one form gauge symmetry.
So B has a translation symmetry. Is it? I say, yeah. It's a.
Okay. And by a tube operator, do you mean dimensional one, or do you mean it's a tube surface which extends in time as
2 plus 1? No.
What's the dimensions of your tube operator? Is it a line, or does it extend in time too?
What is the dimension of which operator?
The tube operator. So you mean.
The Toft. Okay. So yeah. So in 3 plus 1. Okay, we usually speak of a Toft line.
No, Toft.
But it's actually based on a surface. And if you're really in BF theory, the surface doesn't matter. But if you have curvature, the surface will matter.
So it is
based on the surface, but what happens is that if you're really in BF theory and there's no defect, the choice of surface doesn't matter, and you generate a defect along the boundary of the surface.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. And then and 2 plus 1 is how everything is one dimension down. Okay. Okay, so actually, yeah, the definition of these operators is actually the most involved thing in all these things, to define them consistently. So let me maybe tell you a bit of of the spectra of geometric observables, and start with the Ashiker-Lewandowski representation, and that's the same thing as in lattice gauge theory. So what happens here is that you take your connection, which in principle is Lie algebra valued, but you consider Wilson loops, which are exponentiated connections. So exponentiating it, you go to the Lie group, and the Lie group in this case is a compact Lie group. So what you have is a configuration space which is compact now, as you do. On the other hand, these fluxes, okay, which you know are integrated in a bit more complicated form and 3 plus 1 over surfaces, they are still kind of in the dual of the Lie algebra, so they are kind of non-compact. So momentum space is non-compact. And so if you have a compact configuration space, what happens is for the conjugated operator is that it has discrete spectrum. So here you also get, it's a curved configuration space, so you get a kind of non-commutativity of these electric fluxes, but it's a quite kind of mild non-commutativity which we can deal with. So that's the reason why we get discrete spectra for the spatial geometry operators in this Ashiker-Lewandowski representation and also in lattice gauge theory. Okay, now let's go to the new BF representation. And what happens there is what we need to do to define really the continuum limit. So it's something you have to do to really define the continuum limit of Hilbert spaces as inductive limit for experts. You need to compactify actually your space of fluxes. Because actually you use that as configuration space because you dualize everything. So what that means is that you are actually only allowed to have exponentiated fluxes. And this is the point which circumvents the uniqueness theorem, because the uniqueness theorem was assuming that these fluxes itself exist. But now we can only use these exponentiated fluxes. And it's kind of a mathematical construction where you basically compactify your non-compact space by adding a point. So now you are compact. You are here compact. And you can ask, OK, now what happens with the spectra? And can be weird things happening if you compactify basically something which is a bit, you know, irrationally periodic, it becomes continuous. So in some sense, it looks actually discrete, but mathematically it's a continuum spectrum. So it's a bit involved, and I can explain that with a picture if somebody is interested later on. But this opens the question. Is there a more natural way of compactifying this momentum space? And in fact, as I told you, what we had with the BF representation is we have now flat pieces. So we can think of flat building pieces which we glue together, and we can have curvature concentrated on these edges. And actually, that's used also in ratchet calculus, and is appropriate for approximating general relativity without a cosmological constant. If you have these flat building pieces, they can be, in principle, arbitrarily large. You can have an arbitrarily large flat triangle. What you can, however, also do, you can approximate a geometry with piecewise homogeneously curved geometry. And so this piecewise homogeneously curved geometry, you can, for instance, imagine that a piecewise curved, a homogeneously curved triangle comes from taking a sphere and cutting out this triangle. Now, from a sphere, you can only cut out a triangle with some maximal area. So actually, in this case, if you use positive curvature, you can have only pieces of a bounded size. And this, in fact, induces a compactification on this space of fluxes, as we will see. Additionally, it has a nice feature that is actually appropriate for approximating general relativity with a cosmological constant. And you can actually define it, and it's basically ratchet calculus with homogeneously curved building blocks. So the idea is, the question now is, can we implement this in the quantum theory? And the answer is yes, we can. And so this we did even more recently with Mark. And the nice thing is that we could use TQFT, which was already there, the 2.0 TQFT, which in fact describes 2 plus 1 gravity with a cosmological constant. Here the point was to not only describe the solutions of gravity, but really to get a representation of the observable algebra, of the kinematic observable algebra in this case. And that was the subtlet thing here. And what this indeed does is to compactify our momentum space in a more natural way. And in fact, you can imagine that it's also given us an SU2. And we have also a configuration space, which is SU2. So we have now a compact and curved configuration space, a compact and curved momentum space. So we indeed find that the fluxes have discrete spectra. In addition, they are bounded. And they are non-commutative. And also the holonomy operators are discrete, they are bounded, and they are non-commutative. So non-commutativity comes if you really have curvature in your conjugated kind of momentum space or configuration space. So what we manage is to feed two birds with one scone. So we have, UV and infrared fineness in some sense because the spectra are discrete and they are bounded. And that happens for all these geometric operators. And we have implemented a positive cosmological constant. And so we can be very proud to have these two main achievements. But this was actually in 2 plus 1, where we used also very heavily the 2.0 TQFT. So what about 3 plus 1? And 3 plus 1, the TQFT picture, especially the defects, are much less developed. And so let me describe the main problem for 3 plus 1. And the main problem is this non-commutativity of the connections. So it makes sense in 2 plus 1. So we are in 2D. Now you can make sense of saying I draw first a line and then I draw a second line over this line, or the other way around. So what happens here is that in the plane I can indeed make sense out of statement I first draw this line and then I draw this line, because you can say it's over or under crossing. In 3D it's a bit harder to define these things, because generically lines do not meet. So how to generalize this non-commutativity of the connection to three dimensions? Additionally, what happened is that due to the non-commutativity of the connection, there's this question, oh, what is actually the polarization we had, which we need for our states? So what is our set of commuting operators? And in fact, what secretly happened is that one has introduced a new pair of connections, which is still non-commuting, but it allows for nice polarizations. And this is if you have basically these Wilson loops go parallel of these two of this pair of connection. And so if you, for instance, just consider the torus surface, it has just degrees of freedom associated to non-contractible curves. So one polarization is given by specifying what happens to these two parallel Wilson loops. And you can also ask what happens with the other two parallel Wilson loops. And this indeed defines a basis transformation, which is now known as S transformation. So here, what we have to remember is that we encode degrees of freedom only for these non-contractible loops on the surface. And that's the key idea to generalize this to 3 plus 1 dimensions. So in 3 plus 1 dimensions, I want to allow for curvature defects, or in general for defects, in the sense that I cannot contract my probing curve across this defect. So these are line defects. And I can choose, for instance, like a one skeleton of a tetrahedron and say I want along these edges of the tetrahedron, I don't allow contractions of these curves. And otherwise, I choose this tetrahedron to somehow embed it in for instance, S3. What one can do is to consider the surface which surrounds this one skeleton of the tetrahedron. So I take a thickening of the one skeleton and I get this surface. And this is just a perfectly nice 2D surface. And I can define now the state space of this 2F0 TQFT on this surface. And OK, that's not just the state space, there are more degrees of freedom. It just shows you have degrees of freedom which are associated to these kinds of non-contractible curves, which go around the triangles of the tetrahedron. And you have degrees of freedom which are associated to these kinds of curves, which go around the edges of the tetrahedron. And now you want to impose constraints which ensure that you don't associate non-trivial degrees of freedom to these triangle curves. And what happens in this case, if you impose these constraints, it actually trivializes one kind of connection here, and you are just left with the other kind of connection. And interestingly, just actually the state space, which you would define for the surface, if you would do another TQFT, which is a Witten-Reschke-Tichring-Thorhaeff TQFT. So this is a state space we are looking for. It describes, in this case, a state space for a given defect structure. And we can now basically allow for arbitrary defects and so get a notion of a finite quantum geometry. And it turns out that we still have these two different kinds of Wilson loops. And interestingly, both operators, now these things which have been encoded in the electric fluxes, are also actually now described by Wilson loops. And the Wilson loops around a triangle or around a face will actually measure the area of this face. And the Wilson loop around an edge will measure the excess curvature on this edge. So both things are now implemented by Wilson loops. And you can also diagonalize both kinds of these operators. So there's a kind of generalized S transformations, which does that. And so it's no surprise that you actually will get the same spectrum for these two kinds of operators, the exponentiated area and this Wilson loops measuring curvature. And so here, it just I have given you the spectrum. And there's some parameter appearing, which I will explain on the next slide. We have one parameter which labels basically the points in the spectrum, J, and L is actually the Wilson loop, which is probing your area or your curvature. And in fact, if you take the limit, K goes to infinity, which means small cosmological constant, you do get back something which we already knew as area spectrum, for instance, in LQG, which is JJ plus 1. So this is finally the star we are looking for, so we got it. So what have we achieved? There's now a new family of 3 plus 1 dimensional quantum geometry realizations. And it's based on a vacuum peaked on homogeneously curved geometry. This vacuum is actually the Crane-Yetter TQFT, which was known. It just was not known how to put defects in. At the same time, what I hadn't told you, that these developments actually implement a quantum group structure into LQG, and that has been basically developed for some time. But it really here allows a rigorous implementation, because what is new here is to really use a vacuum where you have homogeneous curvature. So it's flat with respect to some kind of Wilson loops. And that allows to implement in 3 plus 1 cleanly these non-commutativity of the Wilson loops. So otherwise, it becomes very messy. This K is called level, and it's basically determined by the cosmological constant. So the Hilbert spaces we can associate to fixed triangulations are finite dimensional. If you go to this inductive limit, you will have an infinite dimensional Hilbert space. But on this level, it's actually very important for us to do numerical coarse graining. And it also implements basically an UV and infrared cutoff. Additionally, these bases I have shown can be generalized and actually adapted to coarse graining. So it really helps with coarse graining, which is basically my one slide and how it helps to investigate the dynamics of the theory. And that's actually only one way how it helps to investigate the dynamics of the theory. So now you can go on and use this kinematic setup to define the dynamics of your theory. You can try that in a Hamiltonian formalism. So you would try to attempt to define Hamiltonians. That has a couple of advantages and has a couple of disadvantages. Another possibility is to go to the spin form formalism, which is a path integral method, which is actually based on basically relatives of TQFTs. So that is very fitting for what I just told you, because we use TQFTs. And in fact, TQFTs will basically define faces for the spin forms itself. So all these TQFTs, if I base my construction of these spin form models on these TQFTs, they will show up as faces in my phase diagram. So the spin form models, you can parameterize. I mean, one parameter which we have discussed here is the cosmological constant. And you can start with different values of the cosmological constant. Another value, you know, then there are different parameters. For instance, you can change kind of measure terms in your path integral. There are a couple of things you can tune. And depending on basically the model you start with, or the point you start with here, which is parameterized by these initial coupling constants, you will flow to different fixed points. And these fixed points are describing kind of these TQFTs, which can be trivial or less trivial. But we already know some TQFTs. I mean, we know BF theory. We know now these Krenieta things with different cosmological constants. So an interesting question is, are there even more geometrically interesting faces? So we have basically Ashtika-Lewandowski phase, which is indeed also one face showing up here, say in red, and which describes completely degenerate geometry. So from this standpoint, it's not too interesting. We have these faces which describe basically flat connection or homogeneous, or this homogeneous curvature. No, this is just some imagine. I mean, first it's an imaginative diagram. I can show you some real diagrams with some other toy models. Yeah, it's supposed to represent the physics of what we call spin form amplitudes, and statistical physics would be called a Hamiltonian, just with the difference that we really use the real quantum mechanical path integral, so which is complex. So physically, you know, we described the Turev or the Krenieta things. They are technically all gapped. The BF theory, it's based on SE2. So you would say it's non-gapped because of SE2. But that's the reason why I had to use this compactification. And then mathematically, it becomes gapped, if you want. But the point is here that what we also want to investigate in a second point is actually the phase transitions.
When you say the FQ, you mean the one form and the true form?
Yeah. So BF theory exists. You can define it for finite groups, for instance. And then it's gapped.
Yes, but also for U1, the gap.
OK, for SE2, at some point, there was.
Define for BF SE2.
You mean the action, or on which level should I On the which level are you asking this question?
So just a classification transformation map. So B.
The B is a two form.
B is a two
B.
Form.
And the B is one form gauge symmetry as well. And the actual
yeah.
B wedge F A.
Okay, so it's one on the
B. B,
end.
Yeah, so
yes.
It's B wedge A, B, B H F. There's yeah, the usual gauge transformations acting, and here you have a translation symmetry, which in fact is then a one form and 3+1.
But wouldn't this be exceed gap?
For SU2?
It's topological.
It's
topological, but the point is here, what I mean is really the problem with the Lie group. Okay, we can discuss later, because I think it's Chow Gam Wen which used this thing, and he claimed SU2 is not gap. Anyway.
Mirka?
Yep.
The lower level. So are you saying that in 3+1 we should think of, our proposal is that there are topological quantum field theories that have the right conditions to become theory of gravity if you add defects to them? Or?
Okay, so there are two different proposals.
Yes.
And there's a very frequent proposal, which I don't share 100%, which in fact you can realize kind of general relativity as a theory, as a topological theory with defects. Where I don't agree 100% is the point that I believe you have always to consider the continuum limit of this construction. Mm-hmm. And so the question, you know, which is the question, which dynamics you give to these defects. And so there's certain disagreement to which degree you have to carry out this continuum limit. For me, what I'm saying is, you can certainly try to start with a theory, with a TQFT, with some defect insertions, and you know, of course, you can drive a phase transition by trying to condense these defects.
So those, even though this was a fictitious diagram,
uh-huh.
What is the meaning of these two axes?
So here.
You have a TQFT.
Yeah, so we have a TQ. I told you that we have a family of TQFTs, for instance.
But that was a discrete axis, right? That was K?
Yeah. So that's one point. That's why I made actually. Okay, so I just had a continuous. You can try to put in your initial spin form formalism, the cosmological constant, as a continuous parameter. But in fact, you will find only discrete values for these topological phases. But a priori, you can try to define a spin form model with a continuum cosmological constant by tweaking something.
But the solutions will end up, phases are labeled by K.
But phases are labeled by K. That's the point. Alpha I just used as a generic name for different parameters you can put into your spin form parametrization. I mean, one example is measure terms, and you can indeed, one simple tuning you can have is to go from this kind of Ashika-Lewandowski phase to BF phase. So these phases you can always find easily.
So the TQFTs then would represent the different values of K, for instance, would correspond to the different universality classes in which this spin form model ends up.
Yeah, I mean, what is that? Yeah.
So logical theory is a starting point, not the end point.
Well, that's where I'm confused about.
No. So one is a starting point in the construction. You add defects, you get something different from a TQFT. Then you do coarse graining. Generically, if you do coarse grain, you always flow to a fixed point.
Which hopefully is gapless. Right? You want gapless.
No. Yeah. But typically, what happens is you flow to a fixed point, which is gapped.
And that would be
you would have to tune these parameters to try to find, to flow to phase transition, which in your term would be gapless. So that's just saying, but it's, of course, what you first find in doing coarse graining numerically is always the phases, if you're lucky. And the phase transitions is something which you are, of course, interested in, and it's harder to find, as you can maybe ask Giffrey. I mean, in all attempts of coarse graining is, so that's why I say that this is kind of a second point of investigation.
So, usually you don't need.
Okay. And indeed, okay, there's arguments for insisting that you need a phase transition, and then there are arguments that some people indeed hope you don't need a phase transition, but I'm rather on the phase transition side.
Usually, if a material lattice which can be gapless, it can be gapless already when the lattice is discrete, right? I can have some big waves of low energy. I don't understand the connection between taking the continuous limit and.
Yeah, but if you say big waves on a you effectively take the continuum limit. Or what, I mean, sorry, Elaine.
I maybe had a question.
Oh.
So can okay, you regular.
No, but.
Excuse me, say that.
I know what you're.
If I took a regular lattice and I took a continuous limit, I would find it very hard to be like, get the graviton.
Yeah, no, but what I'm saying is that generically, you can, what happens without fine-tuning, you take a generic discretization, even of a scalar field, and you do coarse graining without adapting anything. You flow to something trivial, or you flow to something gapped.
Yeah,
so you have to fine-tune to.
No, okay. I'm okay with fine-tuning, but suppose I have a regular lattice with this model,
uh-huh.
I fine-tune.
Uh-huh.
Am I supposed to find a graviton?
Yeah, that's.
From a regular lattice?
Yeah. Okay, the point is that. The hope is to regain diffeomorphism symmetry, and this diffeomorphism symmetry will also give you lattice independence.
What confuses me is usually, when I, often, at least when I take continuous limit of lattices, I get a quantum field. Gravity is not a quantum field. So, what is the what is the key ingredient which is making this lattice different?
You're asking very advanced questions. So if you say gravity is not a quantum field theory, okay. So this feature, which I think you mean, quantum gravity has to be a bit non-local to some extent, and indeed, I hope that I can capture that with a consistent boundary formalism, and that is all an interpretation of how you have to interpret these phase diagrams and these flowing things. So it's a bit more involved to explain that. Maybe I just have a few slides left and I just go there and we can discuss it after. But I assume that what you mean is not the quantum field theory. Okay.
Well, not stress tensor, things like that.
Ah, so no energy, okay. So I can be. I will discuss later.
Yes.
I mean, okay, so that was the application to the one application how it can help for the dynamics, for investigating the dynamics of quantum gravity. Here's a bunch of other applications which you can do with having this nice lifting technique, because I applied it to one specific theory, but you can actually apply it to other theory. And mathematical physics is actually related to new 4D topological invariants, which were constructed recently. And condensed matter, these TQFTs are related to topological phases or topological insulators. Also, you can play around nicely with electromagnetic duality in a geometric context. I mentioned the different advantages if it comes to coarse graining. And we can use it to define a new family of bases for lattice gauge theory or quantum gravity, which are adapted to coarse graining schemes. And finally, these constructions, they actually provide a quantization of a phase space which was considered by Aldo Riello here in France, and is indeed supposed to construct spinform amplitudes with curved simplices, again using TQFTs like Chern-Simons theory. So the nice thing is that this has also a couple of applications outside quantum gravity. For quantum gravity, these developments restore a very close relations, which was postulated a long time ago, between loop quantum gravity and TQ of T. And as I tried to explain with this phase diagram, it's crucial for the continuum limit and getting a geometrical phase, which usually is the main problem of quantum gravity approaches. let me just say here that this opens up these new quantum geometry realizations. They open up a completely new perspective because there's a question, you know, are there, how many different quantum geometry realizations are there? It's basically the same as how many TQ of Ts are there with a geometric definition and 3 plus 1? And in 3 plus 1, we don't have a complete classification of TQ of Ts. so that's one question. The other question is that even on this kinematical level, you can make predictions about the dynamics. And to now investigate how these predictions depend on the choice of representation, of course. And that will give us a better understanding of how universal are the predictions which we derive. so here's a mind map again. So we discussed just shortly new quantum geometries and how that helps to investigate the phase diagram of quantum gravity. There are more points here. And indeed, I am not going to run away soon, so you can ask me questions, but you can run to the buffet. But I still promise you the cutest picture of this talk. So everyone which is on this picture has now to hide. And you can guess which year it is. Thank you for listening. So this used to be PI some years ago. And it would be nice if you would do these Christmas greetings again.
Who's the Santa with the beard?
Yeah, that was a big boss.
Yeah, so in 3D, it's clear how to link gravity and TKFT, but in 4D, is there some Lagrangian picture which says, if I take my TQFT and add a lot of defects, it clearly becomes, I see the Einstein-Hilbert action or something.
Yeah,
can
so, you see that? So the clearest one is from what we call the Plebansky action.
Well, this I understand, but then the objection I would always make to this is that you're breaking the gauge symmetry of B, you link this action to the Plebansky action.
Yeah, but you want to break this gauge symmetry of B.
So this is what the defects do?
Yeah, I mean, one is, okay, so the idea of this, okay, should I write the Plebansky action? Because I don't know if people know what it is. So you have something, you have B, which F, okay, you can add further terms, but eventually.
Could somebody turn the board lights on?
You have various indices, but you have these so-called simplicity constraints which you impose with via Lagrange multipliers. And you are right, it breaks this translation symmetry. Mm-hmm. But you do have these two kinds of gauge symmetries here, and these two kinds of gauge symmetries are turning the theory into a topological theory, which means that you have many degrees of freedom, but then you kill all these degrees of freedom with your gauge redundancies. So if you want to have some leftover physical degrees of freedom, like the graviton, you have to break these gauge symmetry. Okay.
But that's a very drastic thing to do to a theory. It's like gauge symmetry is exactly the same as introducing new fields.
Yeah.
So I suppose my question is what you're doing with your discretization, you're taking this theory and you're adding continuum of defects.
Mm-hmm. That's what you want to do.
And do you think that will break the gauge symmetry to bring it to this?
Mm-hmm.
Is this the idea?
Yeah. So the question is if it works in the end. And that you have to investigate the continuum limit. So So that's what I'm trying to do which I didn't talk about. So on the first part is a question, does it work on some kind of discrete level? And okay, you can consider that in the discrete and consider equation of motion and basically encouraging results.
I guess the question was asking about the second order phase transition was that, so usually if you have a second order phase transition, the deformation away from it is kind of some relevant operator. You're continuing here. This presumably cannot happen in gravity where.
So, I know, I think the point you had with the energy, one has to be careful with this notion of gapless and gapped indeed. Because a priori there's no notion of energy, we just have the constraint. But if you use graviton always refers to some asymptotic structure or some flat structure, in which case you have at least some quasi-local notion of energy, which you can then use to apply that thing. So you have to decide whether you use the language of gravitons and complain about this language of gapless versus gapped, or whether you don't use it at all. So one has to be a bit careful with the language.
So you have this sort of regular array of defects. So this has some discrete translation symmetry and something like that. Does this have anything to do with?
So you're saying you have a discrete translation symmetry because of the symmetries of the lattice.
Yes, I mean, if you take a regular lattice.
What you actually want
to do with the finite diffeomorphisms.
No, what you actually want to do is not to have a diffeomorphic symmetry based on the form of the lattice, but really in the kind of labels on your state. So if you showed this picture of the diffeomorphic symmetry, and of course I drew this example of the tetrahedron here. I told you, okay, I get the diffeomorphic symmetry is kind of effectively translating these vertices. But if I drew this picture, I actually mean that you can also not translating these vertices in the picture, but you have labels on these edges which you sum over, and the symmetry is setting equal different label configurations. So you want this diffeomorphic symmetry to really arise as a redundancy between different kind of configurations, which you then can interpret in terms of this vertex translation. Well, that's actually happens with BF theory, because you don't translate any letters in BF theory, but you say B is translated. But B is actually the same thing as E here. So it's really just the labels which get translated. And 2 plus 1, this indeed is giving you the diffeomorphic symmetry.
I'll ask you later.
Okay. Yeah.
So people are talking about diffeomorphisms. So to give it a mathematical, I mean, its usual meaning, you have a manifold in the structure. You still have a manifold, topologically at least, differentiable manifold, or are you really formulating this in a way that all that is there in the end is the graph?
Yeah, so in this discrete case, I mean, I define the diffeomorphic symmetry as a property of the dynamics, and that was an important point. here. It's a question whether the action has actually any directions in which it is constant at the maximum. So that for me is basically, you know, if basically your solutions are degenerate, that's for me the definition of a diffeomorphism symmetry. It turns out that in fact, for instance, in Ricci calculus, you indeed need the symmetry to make sense out of constraints, to make sense out of the right number of degrees of freedom, and it indeed gives you this picture of vertex translations. And so you can really identify that as a diffeomorphism symmetry. So in this case, you could say, indeed, you're not talking about a manifold anymore, and it's just a symmetry associated to this discrete structure. But it's really important that you always put the action there, because the perfect action is the one which could give you diffeomorphism symmetry, whereas, you know, just the Ricci action in 4D does not give you
diffeomorphism in a more general way, in certain cases.
So I use it, if I say there is a diffeomorphism symmetry or it's broken, it's a property of the dynamics of the system.
Okay, but so far you were talking mainly about kinematics.
Uh-huh.
So can we say whether, did we have to take the next step before you could even decide whether there was diffeomorphism symmetry?
For space-time diffeomorphism symmetry, you would need to speak about dynamics. So for space-time diffeomorphism symmetry, that's indeed for me imposing dynamics consistently is basically equivalent to imposing space-time diffeomorphism symmetry and having the right number of degrees of freedom.
Okay, so I'm not sure how to ask these questions because the picture is not entirely clear to me in some places, but if you just look back at how people used to talk about canonical quantum gravity,
mm-hmm.
the language was somewhat different. So it was all in terms of constraints.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of diffeomorphism invariance was equated to a consistent representation of the
uh-huh.
constraints.
Uh-huh.
Here we didn't hear anything about the constraints as such.
Yeah.
Some of them, can you say something about?
So I can say if you have this perfect discretization, you can define a consistent set of constraints. And if you don't have a perfect, and that's what the connection, that's important indeed for the interpretation of the diffeomorphism constraints as diffeomorphisms, because indeed it leads to the definition of Hamiltonian and diffeomorphism constraints, or spatial diffeomorphism constraints. So if you don't have this diffeomorphism symmetry in the action, you will not get a consistent constraint algebra, but you get something which was introduced as pseudo constraints. So for me, this aim, indeed, many people for a long time, canonical quantum gravity, had this aim to have a representation of this constraint algebra, and the point is to get an anomaly-free representation. But this you can realize by trying to impose diffeomorphism symmetry. And the question is, in which picture is it easier? Is it to be easier in the canonical picture or in the covariant picture? And at the moment, I think it's easier in the covariant picture. But once you have
that,
Does
that mean with spin forms or what?
Yeah,
with
spin forms. Yeah. I mean, what people now do is in the canonical picture is to define Hamiltonians, which have their problems or might have anomalies, and then the question is usually what do you do with them? So there's a more direct path forward in the covariant picture where you can start with these models and improve them via cross-training.
So most of your discussion was in the canonical picture today.
Yeah.
Is the message in the end that we
I made this definition of quantum. I mean, I don't make a big difference between canonical and covariant, because nowadays we know how these things go together, and I made this difference between kinematical kinematics and dynamics, and kinematics is for me more what you call canonical. But these investigations are important to have a proper definition of your covariant constant limit.
But spin forms are necessarily what you call dynamic. Is that not correct?
Spin forms try, I mean, there isn't, these attempt you to define, or it's a discretization of the dynamics of quantum gravity. Okay.
Here you go.
Okay. I think you should then think that way.